You're listening to a Bible study by Jack Kelly. For more free Bible study resources, visit our website at gracethroughfaith.com.
All right, well, this session is Revelation 17 and 18. We have come really to the end of the Great Tribulation. And in Revelation 17 and 18, John backs up here a little bit to fill in some details that were alluded to in just two little verses earlier on. In Revelation 14, he talks about Babylon the Great falling. I think it's 14:8. And that very phrase will be repeated here tonight in Revelation 18. And then in Revelation 16, verse 19, it says the great city split into three parts, that's Jerusalem, and the cities of the nation collapsed, and God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. And so that sentence then begins the discussion that we'll look at here. There is so much detail given to Babylon. There are six chapters in the Bible that are totally devoted to the destruction of Babylon. Isaiah 13 and 14, and Jeremiah 50 and 51, and then Revelation 17 and 18. And so there's a great amount of detail. We're not going to be able to cover it all, of course, but some of it will be self-explanatory as you read it. Since the beginning of time, the story of the Bible has been the tale of two cities. One is Babylon, the city of man, and the other is Jerusalem, the city of God. And all through history, there's been contention between these two cities. All of the true religion emanates from the city of God, Jerusalem. All of the false religion emanates from Babylon, the city of man. And right from the start, and you know, of course, Jerusalem wasn't always known by that name, so the city predated our naming of Jerusalem by some time. But the first pagan religions, the first counterfeiting of the relationship between Jesus and Mary, the first counterfeiting of the resurrection, the first counterfeiting of all the things that are scriptural truths that we hold to be dear, all that began in Babylon. And through the ages, the false religion of Babylon has contaminated just about everything. If we knew the extent to which Babylonian pagan system has contaminated even Christianity, you can't name an important holiday in Christianity or important tenet of Christianity that hasn't been either plagiarized in the Babylonian religions or borrowed from them. And the reason for that is because after the fall of Babylon, the pagan system didn't disappear. It just spread through the other countries, and all these pagan gods had their origins there in Babylon, and were just given different names as they went from country to country. And the Greeks had a name for them, the Romans had a name for them, the Egyptians had a name for them, but they're all the same gods as those which were developed in Babylon. And so God has a very special score to settle with the city of Babylon, and tonight we're going to see that happen. I won't go into all the detail. You can look on the website and get a lot of stuff about Christian holidays and the pagan influence of those holidays and how they all came to be and how it turns out that we have Easter bunnies and eggs and things celebrating the resurrection of Jesus. You know, how do those two fit together, and why do we have the Yule log and mistletoe and evergreen trees and stuff like that at Christmas? What's that have to do with the birth of the Lord? And all of that actually has been brought into Christianity from Babylon. And so it has made a huge mess of all the world. And God has not, this has not passed his notice. He's been aware of this all along. And it seems like sometimes it seems like he's let it go just to see how bad it would get. Of course, he knows how bad it will get because he knows the end from the beginning. But the surprising thing is that we aren't surprised by how bad it can get. And so tonight we're going to look at the fall of Babylon, and you'll find out that it takes three different components to make up Babylon completely. There is a religious component, which I've just touched on, the Babylonian pagan religious system that has inculcated everything in the world. Then there's a commercial Babylon, which we're going to take a good look at tonight. And we find that all of the world's commercial system that many men and women on the earth literally worship emanates from Babylon. And then we have the government, the Babylonian government. And so the three things with which the Babylonian system has tempted man down through the ages are the pagan religion, the promise of prosperity, and the promise of self-rule. And those are three things that man really gets turned on about. There's nothing we like better than to be able to create our own gods, and so we don't have to be responsible to some. I'm not talking about you and me here. I'm talking about everybody else in the world. We create our own gods because we don't like to be responsible to anybody. So if we create the god, then he's actually responsible to us, not us to him. And the second thing is the promise of prosperity. That's something that we all have spent all of our lives dreaming about. And the third thing, the thing that actually got Satan in so much trouble, that is self-rule. I want to be autonomous. I want to be able to do whatever I feel like doing, whenever I feel like doing it, and I don't want to be accountable to anybody. And that is one of man's deepest desires. In fact, in all my years as a management consultant, I concluded beyond a shadow of doubt that the most powerful motivator you can provide for anybody in any kind of circumstance is to give them autonomous control. Tell them you can do whatever you want and you don't have to be accountable to anybody. And you will find you will be able to get a person more excited and more turned on about what you're asking them to do than you can imagine. I believe truly that is at the heart of all the multi-level marketing schemes. It's at the heart of independent businesses. It's at the heart of almost everything that we find that mankind gets excited about is here is something that I can achieve autonomous control over. I can be my own boss and I don't have to be responsible to anybody. And so to the extent that you can do that for somebody, you can get that person to do whatever it is that you'd like to have done. And so these three things, the create our own religion, create our own prosperity, and in a sense, create our own world, be our own God, is what it all boils down to. And that's the very thing that Satan got judged for. And let me tell you, mankind is every bit as guilty as Satan is, because which one of us has not at some time in our life wanted to rebel against authority, wanted to rebel against convention, and wanted to be our own God? That's what it all comes down to, isn't it? We want to be our own God. I want all the riches, I want all the authority, I want all the power, and I don't want to have to answer to anybody. That makes me my own God. What are you laughing at? So, you think this sounds pretty true about me, huh? Is that what you're saying? Well, I won't deny it. I won't deny it. But if you stop to think about it, Satan was guilty of nothing more than that. And yet, every one of us has committed that same sin. And it's an incredible testimony to the grace of God that he has held out redemption for us when we are every bit as unworthy and every bit as guilty as Satan himself is. We just haven't had a long enough time to cause as much trouble as he has, you know. But if you gave us the amount of time that God has given him, we could cause every bit of the same amount of trouble as he has caused. And yet, God loves us so much that he has said, if you'll just accept the fact that I died so that you could live, then all is forgiven and all is forgotten. It's quite an incredible thing. Unfortunately, no such agreement was made concerning Babylon. And so, first place, Babylon rejected all that. And so that put the Babylonian system outside of the parameters, if you will, or the confines or the conditions of God's forgiveness. And instead of accepting his offer, the Babylonian system said, no way. This town's too small for the two of us, it's going to be a fight to the death, and the best man, let the best man win. And of course that'll happen, and we'll see it tonight. So I don't mean to be a preacher, but this is a powerful notion here that's come out of Babylon. You can see why the world has been so beset by it. And tonight we're going to see a lot more of the extent to which this has affected all of us. But with that said, let's now go back to Revelation 14, verse 8, where we're in the three angels that come out of the trumpet judgments. And the second angel, this is verse 8, followed and said, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, which made all the nations drink the maddening wine of her adulteries." All right, and remember when we went through this a couple of sessions ago, I said this is the prediction of the fall of the Babylonian religious system. Because when the Lord talks about his people committing adultery, what he's really talking about is pagan idol worship. The Lord, always, or not always, but quite often used our idolatry, our unfaithfulness to him, described it in sexual terms, partly because the people understood that, because the pagan religions were all very sexual in their nature. It was a sexually oriented religion. And so they understood that. They understood the unfaithfulness and the concept of adultery and fornication and things like that. But when he says that, and symbolically, what he's talking about is false religion. And so that was our clue that the pagan religious system that's represented by Babylon had to be judged. Now, it turns out that if you look at the overview of the book of Revelation carefully, you discover that the fall of the religious system had to happen pretty early in the period we call the Great Tribulation, because part of the appeal to the religious system was, especially in its neo-pagan sense, is that the so-called New Age or the Eastern religions have sort of made everything God. And so God is everything. God is in everything. In fact, have you ever heard the joke about the New Age prophet and the hot dog vendor? What did the New Age prophet say to the hot dog vendor? "Make me one with everything." And so, and that's exactly that is exactly how the New Age has seen religion. God is within us. God is around us. We are God, and we're all parts. And God is just this big consciousness, and we're all part of it. Okay, well, that worked pretty well for the first half of Daniel's 70th week, because as we're going to see here in a few minutes, the Antichrist used that one world religion as a part of his the vehicle for his drive to power. In fact, we're going to see here in a few minutes that the Antichrist is called the Beast throughout Revelation, and now we're going to see the woman riding the beast. Well, the rider is always in control, and the woman represents Mystery Babylon, the mystery religion. And so here you had at the outset, you had the religious system controlling things, and the Antichrist kind of riding along. Well, there comes a point, though, when the Antichrist said, "Wait a minute, I'm God. I want to be God." And what good would it be for him to be God if everything is God? I mean, he could stand up in the temple and say, "I'm God," and everybody could say, "Hallelujah, so are we. And we're all here together." But he didn't want that. Second Thessalonians said he wanted to exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped. And so in order for him to stand in the temple and proclaim himself to be God and make that stick, he has to do away with the notion that everything is God. He has to bring the world back from a pantheistic, everything is God perspective, to a monotheistic, only he is God perspective. And so what we're going to see in Revelation 17 here is something that happened early in the Great Tribulation. And that's why you saw it mentioned in Revelation 14. You know, the Great Tribulation started on earth in Revelation 13 with the introduction to the Antichrist. And that's why you saw the religious system being destroyed in Revelation 14, because as soon as he consolidated and got control over everything, then he has to do away with the religious part of the Babylonian system. Later on, when we get to chapter 18 in a few minutes, then comes the destruction of the commercial and governmental system. So there's three components to Babylon you have to remember, and one of them gets destroyed at the beginning of the Great Tribulation, the other two get destroyed at the end. Okay, then with that in mind, let's go and we'll look in Revelation 17. And verse 1 says, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. And verse 2 says, with her the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. And so now you know we're talking about the religious component here to Babylon. All right. Verse 3, then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. And there I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and ten horns. Now, that's the third time, I think, we've seen this beast described as having seven heads and ten horns. We saw it first in Revelation 13 with the introduction of the Antichrist. He was a beast with seven heads and ten horns. Now we see another beast with seven heads and ten horns. And we're also going to see it a little later on in the chapter here. And so we notice that this is speaking of the Antichrist. And so the Antichrist is portrayed here as the beast, and the woman is portrayed as the rider. So she's the one in control. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold and precious stones and pearls. Now that's a little clue that we'll take a look at here, because that identifies this as a primarily Gentile entity, this religion. Because you see, pearls are not kosher, because oysters are not kosher. And so you won't find pearls being prized among Jewish, especially Orthodox Jewish people, and never did. Solomon made a fortune selling pearls to the Gentiles, but the Jews never bought them because they were unclean, and it was not even a good idea to have them around. And so anytime you see something where pearls is identified, you know you're talking about something Gentile. So for instance, in the kingdom parables, when you talk about the pearl of great price, you're talking about the church. The treasure in the field that just precedes it is Israel. And so the two parables talk on one hand about Israel, the treasure in the field, and on the other hand about the church, the pearl of great price. And if you put them together like that, they make perfect sense. We'll do that someday. Now she held a golden cup in her hand, filled with the abominable things and the filth of her adulteries, and this title was written on her forehead, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. Verse 6, I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. And of course, nobody has persecuted true believers more diligently than the church. Okay, because it sounds like an oxymoron, but that's kind of the way it's turned out, isn't it? The true believer always has been persecuted. Now, why is this called Mystery Babylon? Well, we'll read on a few minutes and find out. We're not quite to verse 7 yet, but when I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Now in verse 7, and the angel said to me, why are you astonished? I'll explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has the seven heads and ten horns. There's the third time. The beast which you saw once was and now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. Now this is a construction of, a counterfeit construction of the name of God. God is always spoken of as the one who was and is to come. Here is the one who was, is not, but will come. And what we're referring to there, and that's another thing that lets us know that Revelation 17 is really speaking about something early in the Great Tribulation. What we're referring to is the fact that one of the things the Antichrist uses to consolidate his power over earth is something that appears to everyone to be a resurrection. Now, I say appears to everybody because I believe only God can pull off a real resurrection. But to all the world, it appears as if the Antichrist was assassinated, or there was at least an assassination attempt, and he was out of commission for a while, but then he came back. And so many, many scholars believe this to be a resurrection. And here's what, in chapter 13, it says in verse 3, one of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. And remember we talked about that in Revelation 13? A fatal wound, by definition, is something that you don't get healed from, or else it's not fatal, right? So if it's a fatal wound that got healed, that means he died and came back to life. And so the world, but whether he did or not, and whether it was legit or not, it doesn't matter. What matters is the world believes that he died and was resurrected, and only one person ever did that, and that's the Messiah. And so that's one of the things that allows him to be seen as the coming of the Messiah. And that's why he can stand in the temple proclaiming himself to be God, because he's done something that only God can do. All right, and so so he uses this counterfeit name, once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss. Now it says, the inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. And so this gives us the this view again that began in Revelation 13, that we're talking about the Antichrist here and his so-called resurrection. Zechariah 11:15, which I think I showed you the other time we went through this, shows that his recovery is not complete. In Zechariah 11:15, we get a description of him where one eye is blinded, his right eye is blinded, and his right arm is no longer usable. And so as he recovers from his resurrection, he is blind in one eye and has lost the use of his right arm. And so you get that from Zechariah 11:15. It's the only physical description you ever get of the Antichrist, and it's hidden there in 11:15 as the false shepherd who takes the nation astray, and that's what this guy does. All right, now we're down to verse 9, and I'm going to back up here in a minute, but we need to get to a certain point here before it makes sense. So verse 9 says, this calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits, and they're also seven kings. And so you're getting a complex analogy here or symbolism. The seven heads are seven hills. Now, we learned earlier that the notion of seven heads is symbolic of supernatural wisdom, which Satan gives to the Antichrist. But here, it also says this stands for seven hills, and that's why we got mystery Babylon on our hands, because, you see, Babylon has never been known as a city on seven hills. But there is a city that has been known that way in biblical times. And I'm not talking about San Francisco, which is also known by some as a city on seven hills. But Rome is the traditional city. If you're going to any group of 100 people and say, what's the city on seven hills? Anyone who knows about it at all will say, well, that had to be Rome. And that fits with the description John is giving. And that's one of the reasons that it's called Mystery Babylon, because it's not physically located in Babylon at that time. And we're going to see how it moves here in just a minute, but I want to take you on just a little bit further. Verse 10 says, there are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come, but when it does, he must remain for a little while. And then let's just finish the paragraph. The beast who once was and now is not is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. All right, so at the time John was writing here, 95 AD, he's saying the seven hills stands for seven kings. Now, the word king and kingdom is identical in the Greek. You have to determine which he's talking about from the context. And it makes more sense here to talk about these kings as kingdoms at this point, because they're not personalized like they were back in Revelation 13. And so at the time when John was writing, we have to look at history to find out who were the five that have fallen, what was the one that was, and what was the one that is going to come in the future. And what you discover there is the easiest one is the one that is. What was the world power during the time of John's writing? Well, it was Rome. And Rome also happens to be the city of seven hills, and so you've got a fit there. Which kingdoms had preceded Rome and were no more? Well, Assyria is generally recognized, along with Egypt. Those two kind of fought back and forth for most of their time. And then Nebuchadnezzar came out of nowhere and defeated Assyria and Egypt at the same time in the Battle of Carchemish in 606 BC. And so Babylon becomes the third one. Babylon was only around for 70 years, and then the coalition of Medes and Persia defeated Babylon And so the Medo-Persia Empire is number four. And of course, Persia was defeated later by Alexander the Great. So Greece becomes the fifth one. And then the Greeks defeated by the Romans. The Romans are the one which lived at that time. And then what's the one that's coming? Well, from Daniel 2 and from his view of the big statue and everything, you had Rome being the arms or the legs of iron. And then you had this feet of clay with 10 toes. And that is thought by most to be the so-called revived Roman Empire. Because of all these kingdoms, Rome was never really defeated. It was reinvented, but never really defeated. The Roman Empire has existed in one form or another all the way through history from its inception a couple hundred years BC. When the political entity that's called Rome was sort of overrun, the religious entity survived, and Rome became the Holy Roman Empire, and was every bit as much in charge of the world during that period of time as it had been before as a political kingdom. And in fact, there were many centuries in Europe where you couldn't do anything without the Pope's permission. I don't care whether you're the King of France or the King of England or who you were, you had to have the Pope's permission to do anything. And so the Holy Roman Empire really ruled everything until about the 14, 1500s, and then components of Rome took over. First you had Spain, was the successor, really, as far as old world, if you know your world history. Spain was the one that emerged out of the Roman Empire to take command of things, and then they were the world leaders, if you will, until 1588, when the English defeated the Spanish Armada, and England achieved a power over land and sea, and that made them basically the world power, and England went into this tremendous rate of expansion. And since then, components of England, you know, England's broken up, but components of England have been preeminent in the world, the chief of which is America, and that brings us right up to today. But guess what's happening? America, many people believe, is in its declining phase, and look what's happening. The European Union is emerging, and a lot of people see that as a fulfillment of this passage that the Roman Empire would reemerge at the end of the age. This is consistent with Daniel 70-week prophecy. It's consistent with the polymetallic statue in Daniel 2. It's consistent with the beast out of the sea in Daniel 7. And lots of places where you can go to justify that view. And so I'm one of those among many, many others who believe that the five have fallen, were Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, and Greece. Rome, obviously the one in existence. And the one that would come at the end of the age is this second iteration, if you will, of the Roman Empire that we call European Community. It may or may not be, but they're still, after all these years, there's still only 10 real members of the European Community. Others are associate members. There's 22 or 24 altogether, but there are only 10 real lifetime members of that. And so we'll have to see how all that emerges. All right, now let's back up a little bit. Why Mystery Babylon? Well, I said it's because Babylon wasn't located in Babylon during this time. Now, the funny thing we're going to see here is that Babylon, like Rome, was never really destroyed in the way the Bible says it will. The six chapters devoted to Babylon's destruction largely speak of things that haven't happened yet, where nobody lives there and nobody will ever live there again. And those kinds of statements are made about Babylon. Most people thought that it was just some of the Lord's overstatement about how he's going to judge Babylon. And most people thought that Babylon had been pretty much destroyed until the first Gulf War. And we went over there, and lo and behold, flying over the place, discovered that the city of Babylon existed. And then people started looking at its history and found out that it's always had at least 10,000 residents, sometimes many more. But it's never gotten any smaller than 10,000 people. And it has always existed that way. And then we discovered that Saddam Hussein had spent millions and millions and millions of dollars restoring it, turning it into what he called a ceremonial city. And there are books written where you can see pictures of modern-day Babylon, the Palace of Nebuchadnezzar, the banquet hall where the handwriting on the wall took place, has been restored. In fact, Saddam Hussein had a, I think it was a $1 million reward that he posted for any Iraqi citizen who could figure out how Nebuchadnezzar irrigated the Hanging Gardens. They can't understand how he did it, and they can't replicate it, and that stopped that part of the reconstruction because they couldn't figure out how to water the gardens. You know, it's a desert over there. And yet Nebuchadnezzar figured out how to do that, and the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon were one of the wonders of the world, and so he was trying to recreate that. But the city itself exists today, and you can get pictures of it. And this was a great embarrassment for many of the leading prophecy teachers in the world who had to backtrack and say, well, we got that wrong. Babylon never really was destroyed. And they went back and read Isaiah 13 and 14 and Jeremiah 15 and 51 and even the passages here. And they say, no, it never was destroyed in the manner that the Bible speaks of. In fact, when the Persians conquered Babylon, they did so without a battle. It was a handy bit of subterfuge that the Lord actually wrote about 150 years before the fact and put it in the book of Isaiah so that when it happened, King Cyrus would be impressed enough to release the Jews. But that's another story too. And this whole session tonight is just fraught with these little sidetracks that if we're not careful, we'll find ourselves here 3 weeks from now, still in chapter 17. But at the time John was writing, Babylon was not the chief entity in the world. Rome was. And so when he talks about Babylon here, he's talking about the Babylonian system. And during those days, it was resident in Rome. And that's why it's been called Mystery Babylon all this time. Well, Zechariah tells us that at the end of the age, it's going to be removed and taken back to Babylon. Let's look at Zechariah chapter 5. And it's my, if I'm reading the combination of history and prophecy right, it's my estimation that Zechariah 5 is a prophecy of the movement of the Babylonian system back to Babylon from Rome following the Antichrist's takeover, if you will, of the one world religion. That he will bring the system, the religious system, back to Babylon into his headquarters, his kingdom, and make it subservient to him so that the last iteration of the pagan system will be not a polytheistic system, but a monotheistic system dedicated to the worship of him. And so God puts it into their hearts to destroy this church, which is his purpose. And the woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. And of course, again, in John's time, that's Rome. Okay, so, and that is Rome as is represented by the religious authority of Rome, not the governmental authority. All right, now that's chapter 17. Let's see how we did there. Did we get just about everything that we wanted to? All right, so all that took place then at the beginning of the Great Tribulation. Now it's 3 years or so later, and Babylon has gone from being a mystery religion to being a worldwide governmental and commercial system. Everything is under the control of the Antichrist. He starts off by giving everybody a mark. You can't participate in any kind of commercial enterprise. You can't be either a buyer or a seller. You can't own a business. You can't be a customer. You can't do anything unless you take the mark. So he's got control over the world's commercial system. And with his 10 kings, he has control over the world government. So he's got a one world government here, and he's got a one world commercial system. And that is every bit as enslaving as the religious system was. In fact, if you compare your situation today with the circumstances that led to the revolt of the serfs back in Europe in the, 1200s, 1300s, around in there? Wasn't it the Magna Carta that started the emancipation of people and began to create landowners and things like that? And wasn't that in 12-something? So ever since then, if you looked at the conditions that surrounded that revolt, they thought it was imaginably oppressive to have to give 25% of the crop back to the landowner at the end of the season. 25% they thought was way too much to have to give back. Would you love to only give 25% of what you get? We are so much more oppressed than they were. The really insidious thing about this Babylonian commercial system is that it allows the illusion of freedom. It allows us to think that we're free. Have we had tax day yet this year? I don't mean April 15. I mean the day after which what you earn becomes your own. It's sometime in July. Up until July, everything you earn goes to pay some form of tax. And after that, you get to keep what you've earned. I mean, if you're going to pay all your taxes at once, it would take 6 months worth of income to pay them. And then the last 6 months you get to keep. And so here we are, we're giving away 50% of our gain back to a government. And of course, don't get me started on the waste and all that other stuff that goes along with it. It's just unimaginable. And because of this, and because of the insatiable appetite of this commercial system, the advertising industry spends billions and billions and billions of dollars creating needs where none existed. I mean, they used to say the key to success was to find a need and then fill it. Now Madison Avenue says, you got a product, bring it to us, and we'll create a need for it. And so a few years ago, we didn't think we needed some things. Now we think we got to have two of them in case one breaks. And so, and it's just over and over again, the things that we're just driven toward buying, I'm telling you, and if you ever try to get out of the system, it's extremely difficult to get out of that system. It holds so many people in such oppression. It takes two and three full-time incomes in many households to just make ends meet. That system has this clause into us, and we're under its control. I was trying to figure out how much this system generates, and all I could discover in my internet search is that the dollar-denominated transactions in the world, the number of dollars that are spent in the world, in the commercial system, is $2.5 trillion every day. $2.5 trillion. And that's just the money that's transferred electronically. That doesn't mean you're going down to the store and shucking out dollar bills for something, which maybe some of you still do. I don't know. Most people don't anymore. But if you buy things on credit, you know, on credit cards and electronic funds transfers and overnight transfers between countries, and it's $2.5 trillion every day. And that's just in dollars. I couldn't get the total in other currencies. But I wanted to give you that just so you'd kind of have an idea as to how big this thing has gotten and how much the world depends on it. And, you know, countries like Iran, for instance, may get away with building a nuclear bomb because we can't afford for them to cut off our oil supply. They sell a fairly good chunk of the nation's or the world's oil, but we may not be able to, you know, the world, speaking of the world, may not be able to risk getting along without their supply of oil, and so we may let them get away with this. Of course, that's just one instance, and there are thousands of these things, hundreds of thousands of them, and it's gotten to be such a huge monster that has taken on a life of its own, and men are enslaved by it. That's my whole point. Even people who think they're running the system are enslaved by it. Technology is the real boss today, if that's what you mean, because it not only enables, but it also requires. And so it's very selfish. It's like this big animal you got in your barn. It provides, let's say it's a giant cow, it provides lots of milk and stuff for you, but boy, it takes all day just to feed him, you know? In fact, I read an article not too long ago where it said that the chief accomplishment of the internet is to be able to get us to spend a lot more to get a lot less, because we're buying so much stuff on the internet, and sometimes we think we're getting great deals. Other times we're not getting good deals at all, and we're spending they've determined it's actually costing us more for the convenience, and we're winding up with less value. And so it's just, like you say, it's taken on life of its own. And so this commercial system has us every bit enslaved as the religious system did. And so just taking out the religious part of it is only the beginning. And then once we get that done, then we got a government. Who thinks governments are not oppressive? I mean, and who thinks they don't hold their people in slavery? All right, so with that in mind, let's look at chapter 18 now. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, and he had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor, and with a mighty voice he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." Now, this is the second time this has been said. And it's saying, okay, now the rest of Babylon is going to fall now. And this is at the end of the Great Tribulation. She's become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird. This is almost word for word out of Isaiah and Jeremiah. All the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries, and the kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries. And then I heard another voice from the heavens say, "Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues, for her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes." So he's actually saying, get out of the commercial system. Give back to her as she has given. Pay back double for what she's done, and mix her a double portion from her own cup. Give her as much torture and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. For in her heart she boasts, "I sit as a queen, I am not a widow, and I will never mourn. Therefore, in one day her plagues will overtake her. Death and mourning and famine shall be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her." This thing, I sit as a queen and I'm not a widow. In Old Testament times, Israel was called the widow of God because God had to abandon Israel because of the idolatry. And so at the beginning, you can see it as you go through the Old Testament. At the beginning, Israel is called the adulterous wife of Jehovah. And then toward the end, it's the widow. Her God is dead as far as she's concerned because he can't have anything to do with her because of the incredible idolatry problems she's created. And Babylon is said to symbolically or spiritually have said at that time, "I'm not a widow, I'm the queen." Now, it turns out that the wife of the founder of Babylon, way back in Genesis 10, the founder of Babylon was Nimrod. You remember Nimrod the hunter? And his wife is Semiramis. Semiramis is the first iteration, if you will, of the goddess of love. Aphrodite is the Greek version of Semiramis. Astarte was the Canaanite version. Isis was the Egyptian version. Venus is the Roman version. And it goes on and on. And you've got these goddesses, and they're all the same as Semiramis. The pagan religion started, I got to make sure I got enough time for you to get all this. The pagan religion started with Semiramis creating a legend that she was supernaturally impregnated by the sun god, and that her son then, whose name is Tammuz, by the way, is the human child of God. One day, Tammuz was out hunting, and in a hunting accident, he was gored by a boar, a wild pig, and he died. Semiramis went into mourning, and 40 days later, Tammuz was raised from the dead. It happened right about the time of the winter solstice. And so all the pagan Christian symbols, the pagan slash Christian symbols like the Yule log, Yule in Babylonian and Chaldean means child. It stood for Tammuz. And at night they burned, on the night of the winter solstice, they burned the Yule log, signifying the death. The next morning they set up an evergreen tree, signifying the raising again to life. Mistletoe is a fertility symbol that relates to all this that's used at Christmas. When you have hot cross buns, when you make hot cross buns at Christmas time, the little X you're putting on the top is the first letter of the word Tammuz. It stands for him, so you're making buns to Tammuz. And all of this is going on here. And this Semiramis was the one who first gave herself the title Queen of Heaven, a title that some Catholics give to Mary today. And the point is, the whole mother-child cult was created there in Babylon. And every mythology, every pagan religion has a version of that story, the mother-child cult. And so you'll find in every mythology a mother and a child, and they are counterfeit examples of Jesus and Mary, and they actually predated Christianity, because the first prophecy of the virgin birth is not in Isaiah 7:14 like most people think. It's in Genesis 3:15 where God called Eve's Redeemer the seed of the woman. It's a biological contradiction, and it's the first prophecy of the virgin birth. And so the mother-child idea originated in the garden at the fall of man, and throughout the ages, the pagan religions have counterfeited this, and so you'll find it in every mythology. And this reference is from Isaiah 47, verses 7 and 8. It's to Semiramis saying, I sit as a queen. I am not a widow. Speaking of Babylon versus Israel. And I'll never mourn. And that was her boast. And so God says in verse 8, therefore in one day her plagues will overtake her, death, mourning, and famine. Let's look at that one in Isaiah 47 for just a minute, because it might state it even a little more clearer than I have here. I'm condensing about 15 years worth of reading on this subject into these few minutes. And so you can if you're not fully grasping it, you can justify yourself because this might all be new to you. In Isaah 47, starting in verse 5, this is a prophecy in Isaiah of the fall of Babylon. And it says in verse 5, sit in silence, go into darkness, daughter of the Babylonians. No more will you be called the queen of kingdoms. In verse 6, he says, I was angry with my people, and I desecrated my inheritance, and I gave them into your hand, and you showed them no mercy. This happened during the Babylonian captivity, right, by the way, which is still futured when Isaiah wrote this. Even on the ages you laid a very heavy yoke. You said, this is verse 7, I will continue forever, the eternal queen. But you did not consider these things or reflect on what might happen. Now then, listen, you wanton creature, lounging in your security and saying to yourself, I am, and there's none besides me. I will never be a widow or suffer the loss of children. Verse 9, both of these things will undertake you in a moment on a single day, loss of children and widowhood. They'll come upon you in full measure in spite of your many sorceries and all your potent spells. You've trusted in your wickedness and said, no one sees me. And your wisdom and knowledge mislead you when you say to yourself, I am, and there's none beside me. And then it goes on with this. And it talks about the sins of astrology and all these other things, sorceries and things like that that Babylon was famous for. And like I say, we could just go on and on with this, but I think you get the idea that God has had this score to settle with Babylon right from the beginning. And he is finally, at the very end of the age, wiping the slate clean. Now, verse 9, when the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they'll weep and mourn over her. Terrified at her torment, they'll stand off and cry, woe, woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power. In one hour your doom has come. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen, purple silk and scarlet cloth, every kind of citron wood and articles of every kind made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron and marble, cargoes of cinnamon and spice, of incense, myrrh and frankincense, of wine and olive oil, of fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and carriages, and the bodies and souls of men. And so you want to buy something, they'll sell it. That's the whole idea. Anything in any commodity that you want to buy, this world commercial system will sell you. In verse 14, they'll say, the fruit you longed for is gone from you. And all your riches and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered. The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They'll weep and mourn and cry out, woe, woe, great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, glittering with gold, precious stones and pearls. In one hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. Now, how many of you have read stories about the great stock market crash in 1929? How people could not imagine living beyond the loss of their wealth. And so you had bodies flying out of the sky, basically, as people jumped out of windows on Wall Street and other places, because so great was the sense of loss from the loss of their paper wealth. It wasn't even real. It was paper wealth. So great was the sense of loss, they couldn't imagine living beyond that. And that was only the Great Depression, from which everybody recovered, basically. Here, it shows the absolute implosion of the world's commercial system. And everyone who sees it knows that this is the end. It's over, and it's never going to be like it was. And the sorrow and the passion that they feel for this. Because these are people, you know, who are not dedicated to the Lord. Those people are all gone by now. These are the earth dwellers. These are the ones who have their heart and soul fixed on the things of this world. It's the entire world commercial system, because why would just a city on the desert, in the desert in the Euphrates River, cause anybody any grief? By the end of the age, the entire commercial system of the world will be under the control of the Antichrist. He will be headquartered in Babylon. The three parts, the religious part, the commercial part, and the governmental. Well, I think the hour is symbolic, but the idea is just like that. Just like that, it's gone. I mean, here it was, and it was all there, and boom, it's gone. And so that's the kind of idea that'll come upon them without warning. It'll happen suddenly, and it'll be over, never to be repeated, never to be rebuilt. And yeah, it's not just the city of Babylon. It's everything that the city of Babylon represents in the symbolic sense. But it's also, you understand, the fact that world headquarters, it's like New York is the United Nations headquarters today. World headquarters, and those at the end of the age, will be in Babylon. Everything will be brought to Babylon. And that's where the Antichrist will rule from. That's where his throne will be. That's where the religious system, the governmental system, and the commercial system all are controlled from there. And just like that, it's gone. All right, now we haven't seen the governmental system yet, but let's keep going. Every sea captain, this is that last half of verse 17, all who travel by ship, the sailors, and all who earn their living by the sea will stand far off. And when they see the smoke from her burning, they'll exclaim, "Was there ever a city like this great city?" They'll throw dust on their heads with weeping and mourning and cry out, "Woe, woe, great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth. In 1 hour she's been brought to ruin. Rejoice over her, O heaven. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets, for God has judged her for the way she treated you." Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, "With such violence will the great city of Babylon be thrown down, never to be found again. The music of harpists and musicians, of flute players and trumpeters will never be heard in you again. No workman of any trade will ever be found in you again. The sound of a millstone will never be heard in you again. The light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of the bridegroom and bride will never be heard in you again. Your merchants were the world's great men, but by your magic spell all the nations were led astray. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and all the saints, and of all who have been killed on the earth." One of the first things Saddam Hussein did when he had his ceremonial city of Babylon ready for public participation was to broadcast throughout Iraq that any young man and woman who wanted to be married could come to Babylon, and he would bear the expense of their wedding. The city of the nation of Iraq would bear the expense of their wedding. And it is said that the reason he did that was to deny this prophecy. And so he read it, and he decided that he was going to show God a thing or two about who is in charge of things. And so when he rebuilt Babylon, he rebuilt it as a ceremonial city, and they have festivals, or did. They had festivals there. They had pageants there. They invited people from all over the world to come there and celebrate, and he encouraged every Iraqi wedding that could possibly be held there, because he was going to deny God this prophecy. It's the same thing, you know, when Saladin, thank you, when Saladin conquered Jerusalem, brought the Dome of the Rock to the Temple Mount. He read the prophecies about the Messiah coming through the Lion's Gate, the East Gate. And so the way he decided that he would prevent that is that he built a stone wall there. And then he began burying people in front of it. So there's a cemetery today in front of that gate. You guys probably just saw that when you were over there. The idea was neither a Jew nor a Muslim can touch a dead body. And so Jesus, therefore, could not walk across that cemetery to come through the East Gate, because he would make himself ceremonially unclean if he did. And so that was his rebuttal to God's prophecy. We'll see how that one turns out. But these other religions, sometimes I think they know more about these prophecies than we do, because they go to great lengths and extremes to try and deny God the fulfillment of some of these things, as if saying, we're greater than your God, and we're going to make this happen our way, not yours. And that's the arrogance, isn't it, of mankind? Okay, you can get online and you can see the pictures of Babylon. You can see the ceremonial city. You can see weddings and things like that. It's beautiful what they've done there, and millions and millions and millions of dollars spent there. And so today, Babylon is nearly ready for habitation. The palace, Nebuchadnezzar's palace, as I said, been rebuilt. The ziggurat, the Tower of Babel, a replica, not full size, of that has been recreated there. And all these things are there in Babylon. And none of that ever got damaged in either the first Iraqi war or in the invasion here. It's all because it's about 100 kilometers south of Baghdad. What happened was after, Alexander, when he conquered the Persians, he set up his headquarters in Babylon. And he drew up these elaborate plans to dredge out a deep water port for the city of Babylon, because the Euphrates River runs right through there, runs right in through the middle of the city. That's one of the things that made it so difficult to conquer, is because they had these gates that went right down into the river, and yet they had constant flow of fresh water through the river, and they had enough acreage inside the walls of Babylon so they could grow enough food for the city, and they thought that they were an impregnable fortress. What happened was, when Cyrus conquered Babylon, he dammed up the river upstream in the middle of the night. The water level went down, allowed the Persian soldiers, to climb under the gates and into the city. They opened the front gate and the soldiers poured in, and they conquered the place without a battle. Nobody died. It was several days before some of the people in the city actually knew that they were now Persian. the place was conquered. But what Alexander was going to do is he was going to make a large freshwater port there, a river port, for all the cargo that came down the Euphrates, because the Euphrates River starts up in Turkey, you know, and it runs the whole length of the Middle East and goes out into the Persian Gulf. He died before. He had the plans all drawn up and everything. He died before he could get started on the project. After his death, one of the four generals that inherited the kingdom was poking around down there and discovered that just a few miles away, 100 kilometers, about 60 miles away, was the Tigris River, because the Tigris and Euphrates both flow through Iraq. The land between them is called Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers. Mesopotamia means between the rivers. And so over on the Tigris River, there was already a beautiful natural harbor. And so rather than go to all the expense of digging one outside of Babylon, they just created a new city on the Tigris River, and it became the center of trade. It's called Baghdad, and that's how Baghdad originated. And slowly but surely, most of the residents of Babylon moved over into Baghdad. But like I say, it was never conquered. It was never destroyed. It never became a haunt for wild animals and jackals and hyenas and things like that, like the Bible says. It's always been dwelt in, and always will be, until the Lord himself comes at the end of the age and wipes it out. And then, if you read the prophecies and feel that they mean what they say, you'll understand that all through the millennial age, the city of Babylon will lie desolate, and nothing will grow there. A shepherd won't even park his sheep in there, because it will just be desolate. All right, now we've come to the end of chapter 18, and I think we've also come pretty close to the end of our time. So that works out pretty good. And so now what we have at the very end then of the Great Tribulation, the final throes, if you will, the final act, is for God to take all the stuff he's got on his list against Babylon and all at once bring the final destruction of that that man-made system that has opposed him from the beginning of time. And of course, it's not just man doing this, right? It's man who has lost his relationship with God and who has become fair game for a relationship with Satan and has become Satan's pawn. And Satan has just played on some of fallen man's natural desires to have a religion that he doesn't have to be accountable to anyone for, to be prosperous so he doesn't have to depend on God. You know, it doesn't take much faith when you're prosperous, right? If you have more money than you can possibly spend, you don't have to give thanks for your daily bread. And you don't even feel the need to do that. It's when you're down to your last slice that you start giving thanks for your daily bread, because you know that if God doesn't bring tomorrow, there isn't going to be any. That's when you start having faith in God to provide. That's when you start reading the 23rd Psalm and doing all those things that we ought to be doing all along. But you see, one of the things that drives us to prosperity is our desire for security, because if your security is great enough, it doesn't require any faith. And faith is not an easy way to live. Faith is one of the difficult, we think, ways to live. Why? Because we're out of control. When you're living by faith, God's in control. We don't like having God in control. We want to be in control because we don't have to worry about it. We don't have to wonder if we can trust him. We don't have to wonder if he'll forget about us or if he'll miss his delivery tomorrow. We don't have to wonder about any of that because we know that we've got it handled. And so Satan trades on those desires of ours, and the result of it has been to create the most incredible and insidious system of bondage worldwide. It's gotten so far out of control that the only way to fix it is for the Lord to come back and wipe it all out and say, okay, now we're going to go back to doing things my way.
Thanks for listening to this study. For more free Bible study resources, visit gracethroughfaith.com.